are going to talk about Wisconsin herps this hour. What's that? Well, you'll find out. We are going to be welcoming in a guest from the Madison Area Herpetological Society. He also has with him a couple of native herps, and we will welcome your questions about native reptiles and amphibians and how we can spot them in the wild. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is coming up on 9 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, May 8th. First, though, urban sprawl has harmed some wildlife species that can't get away from humans on their own. But one Wisconsin project is trying to move little critters back onto protected property in suburban areas. Chuck Kornbach tells us about relocating salamanders.
At the Pike Lake unit of the Kettle Moraine State Forest near Hartford, there are ponds that at least at this time of year have lots of water in them. Wildlife scientists say in that water there are enough salamander eggs that removing some won't harm the ecosystem. On this day, as frogs croak nearby, five researchers put on waders and head into one of the ponds. During 10 or 15 minutes of looking at submerged grasses or tree branches, one person locates just a small sack of tiger salamander eggs. But then Emily Biaggi reports a larger find.
Yeah, there's probably a good 20.
What do they feel like?
Oh, slime. A slime ball.
But this is one slime ball that's good to have, as the jelly-like sack and about 10 other egg masses containing a total of maybe 300 eggs are eventually collected and put into a bucket half-filled with water. Jason Nichols says the bucket is headed to the restored site where he works, the Mequon Nature Preserve. Nichols says wetlands draining, farmland development, parking lots, and home building in the Milwaukee suburb decades or just a few years ago killed many salamanders, and it's been hard to get them back.
In our area, because we're surrounded by farm field and by urban setting, it's very difficult, if at all possible, for some of the, especially amphibian species, to be able to relocate themselves to a habitat that's very suitable for them.
Scientist Gary Casper of the UW-Milwaukee says these salamanders are not a threatened or endangered species in Wisconsin, but he says distributing them to places like Mequon makes sense biologically.
Yeah, the more populations you have, the more stable the species is, because each population is subject to its own local impacts.
Lisa McCabe of the DNR says spreading healthy populations of salamanders may also reduce local risks from chemicals.
You know, amphibians in general are just much more susceptible to toxins in the environment because of that permeable membrane of their skin, and therefore are going to be much more sensitive to chemicals in the environment.
The Natural Resources Foundation is providing some of the money for the salamander relocation. Spokesperson Lindsay Rennick-Mayer calls it a potentially good investment.
If they're able to bring back populations of salamanders where they should be in our state, that's pretty amazing for such a small amount of money.
With that, the bucket of salamander eggs is loaded into a pickup truck for the 25-mile drive to the Mequon Nature Preserve. Once there, Emily Biaggi carries the bucket into a pond in a small woods and slowly pours the eggs into a submerged protective wire screen. The preserve's Jason Nichols says only about 10% of all the eggs brought in will make it to become full-sized salamanders. But he says that's pretty good.
With amphibians, because they don't have much in the way of defenses for being in the water, the game is to just get as many eggs in as possible.
Nichols says the preserve also this spring brought in eggs of blue-spotted salamanders from a nature center in Bayside. He says the hope remains to create a strong breeding population at Mequon. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
So, how cool is that? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk about salamanders and snakes and turtles and frogs and other native amphibians and reptiles. Talking with our guest expert, our guest enthusiast, Ryan McVeigh, president of the Madison Area Herpetological Society. He has been keeping reptiles since he was 7 years old. He has been breeding snakes in captivity for the past 8 years, and he has joined us with some of his herp friends to talk about Wisconsin's native amphibians and reptiles. Good morning, Ryan.
Hey, good morning.
Good to have you here. We talked to you once before, and you brought in some different animals for me to meet. This time, you did bring in a salamander. Let's talk about the salamander first, since we just heard about that relocation project. What are there different types of salamanders in Wisconsin?
Yep, there's multiple species of salamanders in Wisconsin. There's tiger salamanders, spotted salamanders. There's actually even a few species of salamander that don't have lungs. They're lungless, so the redback salamanders and the four-toed salamanders.
How can they be lungless?
they actually breathe through a passive system through their skin.
Oh my goodness! Well, so what's your reaction to this story to relocate them to bring the salamander back to suburban areas?
I think it's a positive story. It's something that I guess a lot of people don't think about, but a lot of amphibians actually are a really large part of the ecosystem and the food triangles and or circle and how all other animals kind of live together in that ecosystem. Amphibians are actually a big part of it. And to be able to bring them back into areas where they were once prevalent, even if they're not endangered right now, is positive, because the more different populations and different areas that they're in, the better chance they have of survival. If any type of disease or anything wipes out one area, then other areas will be able to make it through that.
Now, this you brought in a tiger salamander?
Yep.
All right, tell us about the tiger salamander.
So tiger salamanders are the largest land species of salamander in Wisconsin, and one of the largest in the United States. They're black to kind of olive brown with yellow markings, a lot of yellow spots, and they're a really cool species. They eat mostly worms and bugs and other types of things.
And you have him in covered up with a little... Just a little cardboard thing. He likes to be hidden away.
Yep, most salamanders they like to live in leaf litter, under debris in the woods, under logs. They like to stay moist because they're an amphibian. In order to breathe through their skin and absorb moisture through their skin, it has to stay wet, so that they could have like a mucus that covers their skin and helps them to stay moist. But they need to stay wet, and they like to stay hidden, just because when you're something that's 6 inches long, everything else wants to eat you. So it's best to try and stay hidden.
Define amphibian for us.
So an amphibian there's multiple different kinds of amphibians. There's four groups. There's frogs, toads, five groups, salamanders, newts, and Sicilians. And they all basically go through a stage from an egg to a tadpole or a larval stage and live in the water. And then they exit the water and live the rest of their life on land.
Ah. And I understand that salamanders and others are kind of on the move, or will be on the move soon, because they move to go lay their eggs, I
yep.
guess. Yeah.
So they've probably mostly already moved, but when the spring comes and the ground thaws, they'll actually climb out of the ground and where they've been in hibernation, and they'll find local bodies of water to go into, and then they breed and lay their eggs there.
And you were not aware of, but there is a site, or was a site last year in Middleton, where there was a sign put up on the road that said salamander crossing, that they actually crossed a road, so they were telling motorists to be watchful.
Yep, and that's a big thing. A lot of times they'll have a specific habitat on one side of the road, and the creations of roads sometimes create these ditches and ponds on one side, and they'll breed there. So actually last year we were involved with a study with a local local business and the DNR to go out and actually track a section of road, and we would go out every night and walk back and forth and catch the salamanders that were moving and take measurements and check their gender and write down which way they were moving and what time of night and things like that.
Oh, cool. And it is, they are nocturnal. They do this, they move at night.
Yep.
And they eat at night, and then they sleep all day.
Pretty much, yeah.
They're antisocial.
Well, they also like to stay very cool. If they get too warm, it can make them get sick or pass away if they get really hot. So to be out at night helps them to keep warm. And plus, it's usually, even in drier times of the year, it's usually more humid at night.
Well, you know, we have a news break coming up next, and then we will continue talking with Ryan McVeigh about Wisconsin's amphibians and reptiles, talking now about salamanders, but hey, we'll talk about turtles and snakes and frogs, and welcome your questions for him. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We'll also tell you about what you can learn about tonight at the Madison Area Herpetological Society meeting when we come back. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. So do you have a favorite reptile or amphibian? Do you like to go on herp walks? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Any recent sightings that you'd like to report, or do you need some help identifying anything? Or do you have a concern about our native amphibians and reptiles? We are talking with our guest expert, president of the Madison Area Herpetological Society, Ryan McVeigh. And again, welcoming your thoughts and questions. And Ryan, we do want to go to the phones in just a moment, but you do have a meeting tonight, which so happens to focus on native species, especially for kids.
Yep. So for the Madison Area Herp Society, we've been around for 4 years, and we do most of our education to kids. So a couple years ago, we thought, well, why don't we have a Kids Herp Society? So tonight, our Kids Herp Society meeting is from 7 to 8 p.m., and it's just about native species. So we're going to cover a bunch of the really unique native species, things like there is actually a lizard in Wisconsin that doesn't have legs. Looks like a snake.
Really?
Yep. So it's called the slender glass lizard. And we're going to talk about those and turtles and, you know, frogs and salamanders and newts and just everything that's kind of unique and cool in the state that a lot of people don't even realize is right in their backyard.
That is so great. And why is it, why do you think it's important that the kids know about this?
It's cool. I love when kids get excited about reptiles. And there's a big correlation actually between kids that are interested in reptiles and amphibians and going into science type related fields in the future, whether that be biology or even things like medicine and any type of science.
Very neat, very neat. And then, so the Kids Herp Society meets tonight, and right after that, you're also going to be talking about, it's not a native species, but you'll be talking about coral snake venom research? Oh my goodness.
Yes, so every time we have a general meeting, we bring in a speaker, and sometimes it'll be someone local, and sometimes it'll be on an exotic species that people might keep or breed, and sometimes it's on research and biology. And tonight we have just an incredible opportunity to be able to speak with one of the top venom extractors for coral snakes. And he's actually coming in and going to be talking about his research, what the research with coral snakes is and the venom, how they were making anti-venom for these snakes. And he'll actually have some on hand and is going to do a live milking demonstration to actually see how he extracts the venom from these small snakes.
And that's in a jar, not on his hand
or
something.
Yes, if it was on, it would not be on his hand. It would be a very, very short meeting.
Oh, boy. Well, we'll put some more information about your meetings on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We do also have some list of information on native species there and things you might want to keep in mind if you want to go on a herp walk. Benjamin in Whitewater is with us, and he is a young person who apparently likes, you like snakes, Benjamin.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, well, tell us. So tell us, what's your favorite snake?
My favorite snake is the Butler garter snake.
Oh, cool. Well, why is that? Why do you like that one?
Because it's rare in Wisconsin.
Let's get Ryan to tell us about the Butler garter snake, and hold on, Benjamin, and how that's different than a regular garter snake.
So that's what's kind of funny with Butlers. There's actually three species of garter snakes in Wisconsin, the common, the Butlers, and the Plains garter snakes, and it's really difficult to tell a Butlers apart from a common. You actually have to count the, where the lines on their sides are and which scale line it goes through. But they are a more rare garter snake in Wisconsin, and they were protected until recently.
And the garter snake is a very friendly. In fact, you brought one in, the regular garter snake, anyway, and he was a bit active though. He wanted to go looked like he wanted to go up my sleeve.
Yep, garter snakes are from a group of snakes called colubrids, which includes milk snakes, king snakes, garter snakes, and they're actually active hunters. So a lot of times they're a lot more active. They're not as sedentary. They like to move around, and you'll see them out a lot during the day, especially garter snakes around Wisconsin. You'll start to see them all over the place.
You know, we were on a hike at Horicon Marsh just last weekend, and I didn't notice it, but a family in front of us on the trail, they were pointing and talking about something, and when we walked up, it was a garter snake, and I had not seen a garter snake that big. The little guy you brought in was about the size I normally see. I don't know, maybe a foot or a little more than that. This guy looked to be much longer than that, and his his body seemed to, I mean, how big do they get?
They can get over 3 feet, and once you find these really big ones, up in Horicon Marsh, he has a plethora of food and frogs to eat, so he's probably a little bit of an older one that's nice and fat from all the food they ate.
Yeah, that's great. In fact, speaking of frogs, Benjamin, I'm sorry, but bring you back into the conversation. You are taking part in a program called the Ribbit Program?
Yes, I do.
And what is that about?
The Ribbit Program is in the University of Wisconsin. Whitewater, Wisconsin.
Cool. And what do you learn in the Ribbit program?
We learn about frogs and how healthy our environment is.
Very neat. And how healthy is our environment for frogs or anything else, Ryan?
The thing is amphibians are actually a really good indicator of environmental changes because they absorb things through their skin. So if there's high toxins or pollution or anything, they're usually the first ones to show effect. So if you find a lot of frogs in an area and they only have 2 to 4 legs and not 6 or 8, or you don't find any dead ones around, then you definitely can assume that you have a generally healthy ecosystem there.
Yeah. And, I'm just trying to think of what to ask about frogs. I mean, they just are... I mean, you go from the little bitty peepers to the big, big bullfrogs, right?
Yep. There's a lot of different species in Wisconsin. And what's really cool is actually, like you said, the peepers. Spring peepers and wood frogs are two really unique species. They don't hibernate, per se. Oh. They actually freeze solid into little frog ice cubes under the snow. And then in the spring, they're the first ones, the spring peepers, that's why they're called spring peepers, they're the first ones you'll hear calling because they actually reanimate once they thaw.
How cool. You know, I don't hear them very much in my neighborhood in Madison, but my sister's neighborhood, maybe because there are more trees. I don't know. It is amazing. It's almost deafening. It's so loud.
Oh, yeah. They're very loud. And actually, you can get CDs from the DNR that have the different calls of different frogs, and you can learn which frogs you're actually hearing and do surveys with the DNR, too, just driving around with your family, listening for what frogs you hear and writing it down. And there's a lot of unique stuff like that where you can kind of help out if you're interested.
Yeah. So, Benjamin, do you have anything else you want to add about your Ribbit program or your favorite snakes, or do you have a question for Ryan before I let you go?
I probably do have a question. When do the bullfrogs come out to call?
The bullfrogs, you'll hear them calling all day, and usually in the all day through, especially in the morning and close to the evening. And generally, you'll see them in certain areas. Bullfrogs are kind of a unique frog because they're common throughout the entire state, but they're usually in little pockets. So they'll usually be around ponds and stagnant permanent bodies of water.
Very neat. Thank you very much, Benjamin, for the call. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. A caller who I guess wanted to talk about peepers just dropped off, so you must have answered that question for that caller. Well, so what's the difference between a frog and a toad?
It comes down to their skin. Toads have a dry, kind of warty skin, and they generally live completely on land, versus frogs, which have a slimier skin, and they're almost always found around bodies of water or near a body of water. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah, and will both of them pee on you if you pick them up?
Yes, almost anything will pee on you if you pick them up, and they don't want to be picked up. Even garter snakes and a lot of the other snakes in Wisconsin will musk you. So they have these glands on the back of their tail, and they let out they give off this rancidly horrible smelling secretion that they'll rub all over you with their tail.
Well, that's a pretty good defense mechanism, isn't it?
It is. It's kind of funny because when the Herp Society, we go on all these field outings and we take two vans and we load them up with people and kids and we go out and we find all this stuff in nature and in its native habitat, and we get a chance to get people up close with it and understand why the habitats are so important. And by the end of the day, everybody's been musked so many times. It's an interesting drive in that van with 15 people that are all covered in snake musk.
Before we move on to another animal, back to snakes, there are two venomous snakes in Wisconsin?
Yes, there's two species of rattlesnake, the timber rattlesnake and the eastern Massasauga. They're both endangered in Wisconsin and protected. The eastern Massasauga is actually federally endangered. So a lot of times something will be endangered in a state, and that just means that the population in that state is threatened. But that doesn't mean that animal is endangered as a whole across the country. But the Massasaugas are. So there's very few of those left.
Yeah, it's interesting because I had heard about the timber, but I did not know about the Massasauga. And so that, I want people going to look for them, but where do you find that snake in terms of region?
They're generally in central Wisconsin, and they like swampy areas. If you actually go to the Madison, the Henry Vilas Zoo, there is a Massasauga and a timber rattlesnake. And the Massasaugas are cool because they're the largest species of pygmy rattlesnake in the world.
And what should you, I mean, if you come upon a snake in the wild, they're not going to, unless you bother them, I assume they're not going to try to take a bite out of your ankle.
No, if you put yourself in their shoes, their eyes and themselves, they're a half inch off the ground, and everything above them is going to eat them. So the only time that they get defensive is they think you're going to eat them, and they're scared. And a lot of times, if you just stand there and watch them, they'll be on their way.
Right. And, you know, the other thing they do, I'm not sure what time of year, if it's this time of year, but again, it was not this last trip to Horicon, but a recent trip to Horicon, where you were being told to watch out for snakes in the middle of the road. They'd come out and sun themselves.
Yep, so they're ectothermic, and they're cold-blooded, and they need to warm themselves up by being in round, warm surroundings. And in the morning, the sun beats on the road and warms it up faster than the air. So they'll sit on the road in order to warm up, and being warm helps them digest their food, helps them get energy to go do their daily activities and climb around, and so they'll spend their time on the road kind of warming up quicker.
And is that any time of during the sunny months?
Generally, it'll be right in the morning. Once it gets into the afternoon, especially in summer, that road will get very, very hot.
Too hot, yeah.
And then they'll kind of try and stay off it.
Ann in Albany is with us. Hi, Ann.
Good morning. Good morning.
Morning.
I had a question about fox snakes. So we live near the Sugar River by the Lake Albany or Lake Winnetka, sometimes referred to. And we had the pleasure of watching this really beautiful fox snake about 4 feet long, who's laying right outside of our patio door. My question is, if I'm correct, I understand that fox snakes have an odor, and I'm wondering if that is in fact true. A couple of times during the late summer, early fall, we've noticed in one section of our house, an outside wall, in the inside, we're noticing this, that there's this kind of pungent, unusual smell. It lasts for a couple of days, and then it's gone. And you know, I've just kind of wondered, is it possible that we might have fox snakes near or nesting in or near our house, or maybe none of this is true at all? I don't know. I guess that's why I'm calling.
All right. So what about this? Could that smell be the fox snakes?
So fox snakes do have a smell, but it's the musk that I was talking about. They can release that musk. Generally, if you pick one up, it's not going to have any odor at all until it gets aggravated and releases that musky smell. It would be unlikely that that could be the cause, unless they were upset and smearing musk all over the walls of your house. But more than likely, that wouldn't be it. Like I said, they do produce an odor, and it's that musk, that they have those musk glands. But it's not generally going to be on them all the time.
Yeah, and unlikely that if she's smelling this periodically, that it's that.
Yeah.
So maybe it's a skunk.
Could be. Could be a skunk coming by every once in a while.
Talk just a little bit more about this fox snake.
Fox snakes are a gorgeous Wisconsin snake. They actually start out with a really unique pattern, and they're kind of brown and lighter brown and dark brown. And as they grow up, their head turns bright red and orange kind of colored. And they become like a yellow with brown spots. Unfortunately, they're actually often killed when people find them because of just the fact that they think because they have a red head that they're a copperhead.
Oh.
And copperhead is a venomous snake, but the closest copperhead to us is 500 miles away. So they're not copperheads, even though they have a red head. And people just with that thought that it's venomous get scared of it.
People have snakes still get a bad rap, don't they?
They do, and it's kind of funny because a lot of people are really afraid of them, but they're way more afraid of us than we are of them. And then on top of it, they're a massive part of our ecosystem, and especially when you look at things like the fact that they eat rodents, and rodents can carry a lot of diseases that can actually be passed on to people. So lower snake population and can be related to a higher rodent population. So the more snakes in my area, the less rodents, and the less rodents that I'm going to be coming in contact with. So I kind of see them as definitely a helper to keep me from getting things like the Black Plague or things like that were transferred by rodents.
Right. Well, speaking of snakes, David in Heartland is with us. Hi, David.
Good morning. This is David. I'm curious. I have a bloodhound that likes to go in the backyard. Bring in little animals. Can snakes, especially garters, be dangerous to pets?
Not really. The garter snakes do. There's a bunch of different studies that say they do or don't, but have a slight, very, very low toxicity venom. It's almost a remnant of evolution to be where they're at now. And the worst thing it really does is it just doesn't make it so you can stop bleeding easily if they bite you. Generally, the only snakes that are going to be a threat to pets or people or anything are the rattlesnakes.
Yeah, so you don't have to worry about your pet encountering one. It might get bitten, but it's not going to kill it.
Yep. No. My dog has had the same thing where she was sniffing a snake and it bit her right on the nose, and she's not a big fan of them anymore. but no harm done. Just little pinholes maybe.
Yeah. Thanks, David. Cynthia in Menominee. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi there. I tuned in late and I apologize. I certainly would have been listening, but I have a question that I'm sure is quite unique. We have lived on our little farm site since 1974, and in that time I've only seen a couple snakes. Is there any way to encourage snakes?
Cool.
Yeah, so it kind of depends. A lot of times they're going to live in areas where they have the things they need, and there's water and frogs and food sources nearby. But one way that you can actually, a lot of times they're just really good at hiding, and you may not run across them that often because unless you're really, really looking for them, you might not see them. But one thing you can do that will help you find them easier is actually lay out boards out in different areas, and they will hide under the boards. So you'll be able to go and flip boards over and kind of look and see if they're there, and it provides them a little hiding spot for them to hang out in during the day.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, Cynthia, we almost have news time. Did you have a quick follow-up?
No, I was just saying that I love snakes, but they're just not around. It's one of my major disappointments of where I live.
Put the boards out and see if they're carefully. Yeah, see if they show up on some boards if you put them out there. We will check news, and then we will be back talking more about Wisconsin snakes and frogs. And when we come back, we'll talk about turtles. Turtle crossing signs are going up around the area, so we'll talk about how to be careful around turtles, how to help the turtles, and welcome other questions you might have for Ryan McVeigh, president of the Madison Area Herpetological Society. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about Wisconsin's amphibians and reptiles. A lot of them are reemerging from winter hibernation or on the move now that it's spring. Some are on the move to lay their eggs, including turtles. And we'll talk about turtles next with Ryan McVeigh, president of the Madison Area Herpetological Society. He's been keeping reptiles since he was 7. He's been breeding snakes in captivity for the past 8 years, and he knows a lot about Wisconsin herps. And Eugene in Viola is with us. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Joy. We have a turtle crossing between Viola and Lafarge. And I carry a pointed shovel in the back of my truck. And when I see one in the middle of the road, I'll pull off on the shoulder and take that shovel and just gently ease it off the road and get it off into the ditch. And I make sure it's right side up.
Good for you.
I mean, it can be a little bit dicey because I've seen some big ones that they'll just about fill that. And they will attack that shovel. I don't hurt them in any way, but I make sure they get off the road. But you got to take your time doing it.
And it's important that you what I heard is that a lot of people will take the turtle and bring it back to the water when it really wanted to go in the other direction, Ryan. So you should move it in the direction it's going.
Yep. So anytime you see a turtle crossing, a lot of time what they're doing is they're actually migrating to find somewhere to lay a nest. So what you're going to see are actually pregnant females that have eggs. And you want to move them in the direction that they're going, because even if you put them on the other side, back on the other side of the road, they're just going to keep crossing. They know where they want to go, and if you try and get in the way and point them in a different direction, they may not take your advice.
Yeah, so, and some of, especially a big snapper, I suppose you do have to take care if you're going to help that snapper across the road.
Yeah, snapping turtles are a really aggressive species, and they will try and bite at you. And a lot of people, there's one thing I'd like to let everybody know is a lot of people say to pick it up by its tail to move it. Don't do that. It's the worst thing you can do. You're literally picking up them up by their spine. It can break their back. You can cause paralysis. Using a shovel, that's a great thing to move them with a shovel or with a stick. Or you can actually pick them up by the very, very back of their shell. Stepping turtles spend most of their days in the mud in ponds, so they will be very, very smelly. So your hands will be covered in very stinky smell. But it's good to be able to help them across the road and find their nesting ground.
Oh, so what if they're doing that now? It's the female turtles are crossing the road, look for their nesting grounds. They lay the eggs, and how long does that take them?
It's about 2 months before the babies hatch, and it's kind of unique. They are really good at hiding their nesting site. I know people who have had turtles actually lay in their yard and cover the grass and everything up back perfectly where they went out an hour later and couldn't find the spot where they put it.
Oh my goodness.
Like they relay all the sod right back down perfect, and they move around the dirt so that it goes down back into the grass and you can't even tell where it is.
Are we going to see little baby turtles then skedaddling across the road going back to the pond then?
Yeah, starting in around July, you'll start to see that, and usually it'll happen at night or early in the morning.
Yeah, Aldo Leopold Nature Center, which is in the Madison area, posted a photo on Facebook today of a baby painted turtle. It looked like a little tiny baby, so some of the little babies are out already.
Well, a lot of those would be ones that hatched really late last year.
Okay.
And then went straight into hibernation, and now they're coming out, and they're just still really small.
Yeah. So 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Darn it, a caller wanted to ask about injured turtles and just hung up. It is very, very sad. Sometimes cars run them over. Don't do that.
Yes, do not. If you can avoid them, avoid them. Obviously, don't fly off the road to avoid one, but definitely if you can avoid it, try and avoid them. And then you can, if you have a chance to pull over, you can help scoot them across the road.
Yeah, is there anything we should do if we find an injured turtle?
You can contact there's some rescues and native natural rescues around that you can contact. The DNR is a good contact. And sometimes they'll be able to take them, but a lot of times being run over by a truck or a car isn't a very easy thing to try and remedy.
Yeah. We also had a caller who couldn't wait who wanted to ask about, was it water moccasins? She wondered if Wisconsin had water moccasins.
So I hear this all the time. We do have what's called northern water snakes. It's a banded colubrid. They're extremely aggressive little buttheads, and if you try and pick them up, they will bite you a dozen times before you even get a chance to stand up. But they are harmless. They eat fish and frogs. They are not a water moccasin. A water moccasin is another common name for a cottonmouth or a venomous snake. And those, the closest you'll find those is very southern tip of Illinois. There aren't any water moccasins in Wisconsin. So all those snakes that are going through the water are totally harmless. They might be a little bit of a jerk.
Yeah. Let's go to Eric in Mineral Point next. Hello, Eric. Are you there, Eric? So he found a couple of northern brown snakes in spring green, wondering if they were babies or adults. I don't know if you're going to know. I suppose can tell us about the brown snake.
So they're brown snakes, or they're called decay snakes. And those are a very, very small species of snake. They only get up to, I think, 12 inches long.
Okay.
And babies are actually maybe 3 inches and about the thickness of a little rubber band. They're worm and slug eaters. They're kind of a cool little snake, and they're one that they have a big personality for being so small. If you come across one, a lot of times they'll puff up and they'll open their mouth and gape at you and try and hiss and try and sound really, really tough, but it's coming from something that, you know, the size of a baseball.
Yeah.
It's a teeny, teeny, tiny little snake.
Yeah.
That just thinks he can conquer the world.
Funny. Where can I find a bull snake? My brother-in-law says they are magnificent. They're huge, apparently.
They're really a snake that when you see it kind of takes you back, because most of the snakes you see are the brown snakes and the garter snakes. Bull snakes are in kind of the central down into southwest Wisconsin, and they can get up to 6 feet long. And a big round as a baseball, and I mean, they're big rodent and gopher and squirrel. They'll eat squirrels. They are very magnificent and very beautiful snakes. They can range in colors from oranges and browns to black and white, and just a really, really beautiful snake.
Yeah. Are there, besides the rattlesnake that you mentioned, are there other species in the state that are endangered or threatened?
Yeah, there is a ton. And actually, if you go on our website and you go to the under educational articles, there's the native species piece there. And that'll actually list out all the different and protected and species, such as the legless lizards we talked about are protected. Bull snakes are protected. Actually, there is a program right now where if you see a bull snake, you can let the DNR know. There's a contact line, and they're trying to track where those bull snakes are and how their populations are doing.
Is it okay for me to want to go and find a protected or endangered snake or any other?
Yeah, so what we do with the herp site, I love to do what they call field herping, mm-hmm. Which is basically just a fancy way to say I hike and look for reptiles while I'm hiking. I spend a lot of time flipping over logs. But a lot of it's a great way to kind of go out and understand the environment and the animals that are out there. But there's some guidelines you kind of want to keep while you're doing it. Like one, make sure that if you flip over any logs that you put them back how you found it. You want to make sure to keep that environment how it was, because you're kind of disturbing their home. So you want to make sure you put it back. And if you don't know what it is, take pictures. Generally, I'd say don't touch it. Even if you do know, you don't want to handle them a lot. Yeah. Just kind of take it as a way to take pictures, and never take them home. Sometimes anything protected, you can actually be prosecuted for taking it home or even touching it. Some of the stuff is protected to the point where you can't even move it with a stick. You can't touch it or disturb it at all. But at the same time, even if it's not one of those and it's legal to have it in your home, they usually don't do really well. Because you got to think, if this, say, little salamander comes from a place where he really, really likes to eat yellow grasshoppers, and that's what he eats, and then you take him home and you don't know that, and there's no way for him to tell you that, and you may try feeding him a ton of different stuff and he might not eat it. Another thing is, animals that are in the wild have internal and external parasites that in the wild they live with, and their body is able to control it, and reptile and amphibian immune systems work the opposite of their stress level. So if they get really stressed, their immune system starts to crash. Well, taking them and putting them into a house with a bunch of people and kids and stuff moving around stresses them out, because it's kind of like putting a gazelle in the middle of a lion pack, and that's, in his eyes, he is dinner. So he's just constantly going to stress out, and the more stressed he gets, the less his body is able to control those internal parasites, and eventually they can kill him.
Yeah, and you say you have a sort of a beginner's guide to field herping that people can get if they go to your meeting?
things?
Yep. Mm-hmm. A lot of times when we do events, actually, let's see, tomorrow we'll be at PetSmart on the west side just talking to people about reptiles and amphibians, and we also have another event that's on our calendar tomorrow. And anybody that comes out and just wants to chat and talk about reptiles and handle some stuff and learn about them, we have handouts, we have care guides for tons of different animals, we have what we call the beginner's guide to field herping, which kind of gives you some guidelines and kind of habitats you want to look for to find certain species, and kind of guides you down that path to go have a fun hike.
Yeah, and boy, we have lots of other callers now ready to go and only a couple of minutes to go. Let me try to bring in a couple more. Chelsea in Brookfield. Hi, Chelsea.
Hi, I'm calling about the turtles that have been hit by vehicles. I am a licensed wildlife rehabilitator in Oconomowoc, and I wanted to let you guys know we do take turtles that have been hit by cars, as do many other rehabilitators in the state. And actually what we will do, we can repair them with special epoxies, and sometimes that requires taking them to our vet, which we can do. But other times, if they have been hit and are possibly dead, we are able to extract the eggs if they are female, and we can actually incubate those eggs and hatch them. So sometimes it's worth it bringing them in, even if you suspect they're dead or that they're too far gone.
Wow. Well, thank you for doing what you do, Chelsea, and thanks for letting us know. And I'm sure there is a list of wildlife rehabilitators that people can find online in their area, too. Well, you know, we just have a minute to go. I know you're hosting a big symposium coming up in November. Anything that we should know about there?
That is the Midwest Herpetological Symposium, and it's going to be an incredible long event for the weekend. It's a great way to come learn about reptiles from top researchers, veterinarians, and even if you're... you just want to learn a little bit. It's a cool way to kind of just come out and meet other people that are like-minded and enjoy these animals. And it's fun to be in a discussion with a whole bunch of people that have the same passion and love for these little squirmy reptiles that you do.
Yeah, this has been fun. Thanks very much, Ryan, for being here. Thanks for all the information. Ryan McVeigh, president of the Madison Area Herpetological Society. And again, they are having a meeting tonight. We'll put information on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Caleb Lato for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.